Great, we're back, and this is going to be an interesting one. I've got Kasian Franks from Vector Space Biosciences. I think, obviously, an introduction is in order, and I'm going to allow Kasian to do that. But I think, just to kick it off, tell us why your company is called Vector Space Biosciences, because I think that's probably the best way to kind of like hit a home run around what it is that you are doing and what it's all about. And yeah, I mean, this is on point in terms of taking crypto to the next level. And yeah, it's good to have you with us, Kasian. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me. So that's a loaded question that you just asked. I'm going to boil it down as simply as I possibly can within a minute or so. So vector embeddings are at the heart of AI systems today. They're at the heart of language modeling, comparing an input vector with an output vector. A vector in language modeling can be based on a word and its associations or numerical scores that that word is given to other words. And again, we're not just talking about, and the reason I say again is because we mentioned this in lots of other talks, but we're not just talking about human language. We're talking about protein sequences as a language. We're talking about visual objects, chopping them up into pixels as a language. You can find patterns in this kind of language, and you store them in vectors. We've been doing biological language modeling in the context of space biosciences for quite a long time. So language modeling at the core with vectors and with vector space being a methodology that you can use, which is what a lot of language modeling is based on today, the vector space model. When you look at a vector space model, it's a series of vectors. Anyway, we're not going to get into the weeds on that one, but if you look up vector space, the vector space method, it is the core method. It's like a matrix. Every vector space is a matrix. Every matrix is a graph network, and every graph network is a vector space mathematically. So when you look at our name as a company, Vector Space Biosciences. So you've got space biosciences. You've got vector. We operate in vector space. So we thought that was the most appropriate name to name Vector Space Biosciences, the parent company of Vector Space AI. So we have subsidiaries. We're an incubator. We'll be engaged in spinoffs, multiple spinoffs. This is how you create real value for, or big value, big and real value for stakeholders and shareholders. You become an incubator. That means that net asset value calculation of every company that you own as a parent company goes right back to the parent company's books as a valuation. You know, the simplest example is if you have a company, a subsidiary, and you're the parent company, and that company is worth $100 million, and you as the parent company have 50% of that subsidiary, while the other percentage is spun off, or whatever it is, $50 million goes back onto your books as a valuation of your company based on the NAV calc, or the net asset value calculation in accounting.
So, I mean, we jumped into the deep end there, and it's actually a great intro, despite the fact that it is quite technical, but I think you explained it really eloquently, and it makes complete sense, I mean, in terms of what it is that you guys are doing. And I'm sure a lot of people are asking, like, so why are we chatting to you? And so we'll go back to the shallow end of this, and it's like, it's essentially decentralized science at the core of this. Well, not at the core, but this is how you are choosing to deliver aspects of what it is that you guys are doing. And I was just wondering, why did you choose decentralized science as that part of your journey? And what does that exactly involve?
Sure. So decentralized science has its roots in what's called open science. And of course, open science has its roots in open software, or FOSS. So when you look at open science, when you look at DeSci, you can look at decentralized science, DeSci, as being part open science and then part maybe a DAO structure, which is very popular among DeSci companies. You make a decentralized autonomous organization, everybody votes on the scientific experiment or the drug compound you want to focus on or the disease, and then it moves forward. We didn't want to get into the complexity of that, in addition to the regulatory issues related to DAOs that are happening today. What we wanted to do is just focus on the open science part. And here's why. One of the best ways to accelerate scientific discovery toward a novel drug compound that might cure cancer, for example, or to a new advanced material, for example, the fastest way to accelerate discovery is to have everybody open up and share what they can, as much as they can, not hide their research. The reason people hide their research is because they don't want somebody else publishing ahead of them, taking the credit, and then they get left behind without any grants or funding. That happens a lot, more times than we want to admit in academia. Now, in order to prevent that, DeSci also solves for that. Because if you're a scientist and you want to publish something and make sure that it's shared, you can put it on chain so that the record immutably goes back to you as the original discoverer or researcher that published first, okay? So publishing first is a big deal in academia. Yeah. And you don't want somebody you don't know just stealing your work and publishing. So decentralized science corrects for accelerating scientific discoveries. Why wait 10 years when you can do something in 1 year, right? And that's what open science does, in addition to providing security on the on-chain and data provenance.
So, I mean, here we have quite a unique and obvious evolution within the space of crypto, because up until quite recently, crypto has always been very much experimental. I mean, you could argue that a lot of what DeSci is doing is also experimental, but it's practical, right? It's practical. You have fundamentals that you can tangibly account for. Like you say, you can publish online immutability, whether you choose to take the NFT route or whether you just record it as a transaction on the blockchain, the ledger records, and it's there. That's great. But then there's another aspect to this, and that's obviously one of the most important parts of what we've identified from a decentralized finance perspective, and that's when you want to raise funds, it's exactly the same mechanism, right? You have transparency, you have ledger. That's something that you guys have chosen to do as well. Can you just talk us through that and the rationale around that?
Yeah, so, you know, and I probably should have mentioned that one of the largest driving forces in academia is being able to attract funding, being attractive to grant reviewers, being attractive to outside enterprises and industry so that they'll fund you. Maybe a large pharma company or NVIDIA will fund one of your scientific efforts or, you know, whatever it is. So funding, in order to attract funding, it's very difficult for a scientist to do that because they spend 40% of their time writing grants and proposals every year. About 40%. A typical Silicon Valley founder spends about 60% of their time, 40 to 60% of their time raising funding. So not having to do that as a scientific founder is extremely important so you can focus on the research. Imagine if throughout the years, over the last 20 or 50 years, people did not have to spend 40% of their time raising funding, but could focus on the science. We'd be way far ahead, you know, just based on the law of large numbers, we'd be way far ahead in terms of scientific research and innovations than we are today. So when you look at scientific funding, you can accelerate that too, based on offering a trading vehicle to people. And everyone must be transparent about this, no matter what segment of the industry you're in within crypto. And that is crypto is, or let's say represents a true global capital marketplace today. Capital markets were designed for companies to raise capital from shareholders, from the public, take that capital, grow the company, and then provide a return on investment. A ROIC, as we like to focus on, return on investment capital. So when you look at a decentralized science company, yes, the big advantage for scientists is that, my goodness, they can raise funding in a much more transparent way, in a way that's a lot faster and focuses on different kinds of restrictions. Let's say you don't have the same kinds of restrictions that you do with crypto funded companies versus traditional Silicon Valley equity funded companies versus Wall Street funded companies versus hedge fund funded companies, or, you know, family offices or something like that. So in the crypto space, you've got unique opportunities to accelerate things. And that is with the funding that which can come very quickly in crypto, that funding can immediately be used to either vote on a new experiment, or that funding can be used to launch biological CubeSats, which is what we do, into LEO, low Earth orbit, or cislunar between here and the moon, or deep space.
Okay, so you obviously have some more wisdom to share in terms of your closing statement. So let's have it.
Well, I can point you directly to the fact that, let's just start here. After the pandemic, trillions, not just one, two, or three, four, 5 trillion was pumped into life sciences. The biggest industry, the biggest. Your life is more important than your money, right? It wasn't just about Wall Street here, or financial institutions, the banking, or or large fund management groups. It's about your life. So trillions were pumped into life sciences to solve for the pandemic, but also to prepare for the next one. There is more money in life sciences and pharmaceuticals than anything else right now. When you combine AI and pharmaceuticals, this means language modeling, the tip of the spear in AI today. When you combine that, multiple methods of language modeling, small and large language modeling, mixing them up, doing all kinds of interesting things, innovative things, and you combine that with biotechnology and the pharmaceutical industry, you can create new kinds of precision medicine for everybody on the ground. So when you look at the kinds of experiments, biological experiments that need to be done in space to better understand either how proteins crystallize, which is what Eli Lilly is working on, Bristol Myers Squibb, Merck, and AstraZeneca. That's another potential revenue generator for us at this point. But they are all looking to utilize not just launch experiments into space and not just launch protein crystallization experiments into space, but understand maybe how cancer spreads much faster in space than it does on the ground, or understand why it is that your telomeres increase in space, humans, instead of decrease like everybody's on the ground, resulting in aging and death. So if we solve for diseases in space, we can make much more effective drugs, much more effective repurposed drugs, make new discoveries. And it, like I always say, it's not about protecting billionaires and astronauts in space, developing countermeasures for them during stressors. That's just one really big part of it, but another big part of it is to prepare the way for new forms of precision medicine for everybody on the ground that result from a countermeasure or a solution in space for an astronaut. You can immediately repurpose that for everybody on the ground. So that's what we're looking forward to doing. It's in the area of oncology or cancer metastases, and your brain ECM, your extracellular matrix. This is where Alzheimer's, Parkinson's are a focus for many companies. So when you look at Merck, for example, launching experiments into space so that they can double their revenue with Keytruda, which is one of their flagship drugs that makes about $20 billion a year, you're looking at a very big TAM, and that's just down here on Earth, on the ground. Now, the TAM in space is incalculable, let's say. The reason for that, humans will be going to space. There will be no lunar bases established. There will be no going to Mars and back. There will be no mining of asteroids, trillion-dollar asteroids, quadrillion-dollar asteroids, quintillion-dollar asteroids, without understanding how to protect and repair the human body in space. This is the big elephant in the room, which is what we like to refer to it as, along with maybe a couple of others. But there's none of this is going to be happening. There's no space race. There's no space anything without space biosciences. Mm-hmm. So that's why we're here, to better help the ground pharmaceutical companies understand how to create countermeasures that get repurposed as precision medicine for everybody on the ground. So that's the revenue opportunity is huge. The TAM is huge. Now's the right time. We might be a little bit early, but we're kind of used to that at the same time.
So how competitive is what it is that you're doing right now? Do you guys have competitors? do you consider yourselves kind of front runners, tire races, second places? Where do you see yourselves in this equation right now?
Well, space biosciences is a lot bigger than what most people think. It's sort of along the lines of people thinking, well, why do we have so many biotechs? Why do we have so many pharmaceutical companies? Why can't there just be one biotechnology company that focuses on all of biology? You know, that's that would never work because biology is complex. There are 10,000 well-known diseases in the world, and that's just well-known diseases. There are about 7,400 approved, FDA-approved drug compounds today. There are about 2,000 new life sciences papers, peer-reviewed life sciences papers that come out every 24 hours on PubMed alone. When you look at what companies have to do in space biosciences, there's plenty of room for competitors. You know, we've got moats, of course. We've got moats of moats of moats. But that just is based on the specialties that we focus on, like the extracellular matrix, the brain ECM, or the inflammasome, or certain omics, other kinds of omics, your epigenome, your matrizome. But it's not just the biology part of what we do. It's also the computational part of what we do. And that includes language modeling and AI, augmenting the data, and then an understanding of how to develop the CubeSat and work with a payload that has an RF transmitter and maybe a Raspberry Pi and maybe a propulsion device, or, you know, and then understand how to apply the language modeling to create graph networks and relationship networks, which is what a lot of pharmaceuticals are interested in, that show hidden relationships between proteins and drug compounds so they can make a discovery. My goodness, I never knew that. And it's not in the literature anywhere. I better investigate this. Yep, it's true. That protein has a relationship with that drug compound. It's a hidden relationship, not a known relationship. And that's kind of what we do. We enable that entire pipeline to happen. So yes, you have to have a few decades, I'd say, in language modeling and space biosciences. And that is a very rare combination today.
Yeah.
With language modeling, again, being the leading edge in AI today. We've been doing language modeling for U.S. national labs for a very long time, you know, before Sam Altman knew anything about AI, in fact. So, you know, we're here, and this is biological language modeling. It's much different than, you know, some kind of general or horizontal language modeling approach.
Obviously, like, the interest for me now is because it's such a topical thing, and it's a big thing in crypto as well, is obviously the AI aspect. And, you know, it's there's kind of like the shitcoin side of things. And I want to obviously get into kind of like your token and kind of like the relevance thereof. But the first part of this thing is like, where did it all start from an AI perspective in terms of the biological modeling? And was it 10, 15 years ago? Is it something that you guys did yourselves? Or did you go and seek out that wisdom from somewhere else and then brought it in? How did that whole dynamic come about?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question because it digs into our history a little bit. I started out at Genentech, which is another one of the world's largest pharma companies. I was asked to find data within their manufacturing pharmaceutical pipelines, find patterns in data. I was provided a book by Joe Seiwert called Language Processors and Compilers, a software compiler. Usually guys that code in C, C sharp, C++, they all have compilers, right? Java, you've got compilers, basically runtime compilers, whatever. So when you look at a software compiler, it is a language processor. That's what it is. Language processing is related to language modeling. Okay, and that was at Genentech, okay? Early language modeling, language processing. Fast forward to the bioinformatics industry, and we were tasked with understanding how to form relationships between genes alone. This was after the human genome was sequenced by Craig Venter and Francis Collins as they raced, and then the government forced them to work together. So these were genomicists, and they were understanding how to cluster genes or classify genes. And clustering and classifying are two different things, using early data mining tools, what we call data science today. Anyway, they were grouping these genes, all lung cancer genes, prostate, breast cancer genes would all group together because they'd have similar vectors or similar expression profiles, as it's called. So, but that didn't give anyone enough data. So what? All these genes are grouped together and it seems like they all are associated to breast cancer, but why and how strongly are the correlations and in what context are the correlations? So that took us on a path of understanding how we could get a machine to predict the capital of Austria, Vienna, ask it a question, you know, and this was a long time ago. And then that led us to understanding hidden relationships between two genes that weren't in the that weren't directly in the literature, weren't experimentally validated, but our language modelers, as we modeled not just human text, but sequences as well, the strength of relationships between proteins growing stronger, whether they were known or whether they were hidden relationships. Because a scientist makes a discovery based on a hidden relationship, not a known. Very few scientists out there publishing something groundbreaking and everybody knows it already. That's not what groundbreaking is. So if you want to make a discovery as a scientist, you focus on the hidden relationships that are not apparent to in academia of any kind. So anyway, that garnered the attention of, because all the vectors, all the vector embeddings in our language modeling, we decided to publish online a while ago. And that garnered the attention of U.S. national labs, in particular, Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. And they basically recruited us. And then we became specialists in that area of understanding hidden relationships between genes, proteins, diseases, pathways. And we worked at the Bissell lab there. This was with under Mina Bissell and Cyra Meehan. And that's where we patented our relationship networker, which is based on vector embeddings. You can look it up today. It's, you know, our pretty much, you know, it's a patent that we're proud of because it was with U.S. National Lab. And then we wrote a paper with Michael I. Jordan and David Blee and Cyra Meehan. And that was based on understanding genes related to extending the lifespan of nematodes or small worms, C. elegans. So we've been in, and that was all based on research associated to chromosomal aberrations, chromosomal translocations. That's what happens when radiation, like galactic cosmic rays and HZE particles, high charge, high energy ions, come from space and hit your chromosome and create double-stranded breaks within your DNA, like that. And then your DNA gets misrepaired, like that. And then you get a malformed protein that leads to cancer metastases, and you've got a disease or some other disease. So understanding space radiation is kind of where we got our start in space biosciences and applying biological language modeling to understand not just literature-based relationships, but sequence-based hidden relationships between all these genes and enzymes and biochemicals, proteins, pathways, compounds, phytochemicals, micronutrients, and other environmental factors so that scientists could make discoveries in the area of space biosciences and breast cancer, of course.
So how does kind of like from a layman's kind of like explaining it to a layman, like how do you take the AI side of things now? Now it's kind of like expanded. So you had your roots and your foundation, and now we're in this world where NVIDIA's topical, NVIDIA's doing what it's doing and will more than likely become one of the, if not the wealthiest company in the world because of what it's doing. And obviously AI is something that's going to be huge for us as a species. But how does this now translate practically in terms of what it is that you guys are doing? And then probably as important financially and converting this AI into, you know, kind of monetary gain.
Sure. So I would say we would challenge anyone to have the knowledge domain expertise that we do in space biosciences, human aging, cancer, based on our scientific advisory board, filled with world-renowned scientists, including Mina Bissell, who's up for the Nobel Prize in Medicine, to understand how to use language modeling at the same time to repurpose a drug compound for Novo Nordisk, let's say it's Wegovy, and understand that it's not just based on its efficacy in obesity, but it also has an application in heart disease. That's an extra $20 billion for Novo Nordisk right there. So for anybody that's been following the pharmaceutical news, where the big money is, you can see these acquisitions happening for $74 billion, Bristol-Myers Squibb and Celgene, you know, back in 2019. It never ends. This is always going to happen, M&A in the pharmaceutical area, and then and in the biotech area, for that matter. But you, and materials, by the way. But you look at the ability to use language modeling, the tip of the spear in AI today, to understand hidden relationships between drug compounds, you can then put yourself in a position to discover maybe a $20 billion reapplication or repositioning, as it's called, or repurposing of a drug compound. So you can only do that with language modeling, or, you know, 1,000 researchers working on a single drug compound every day, 24 hours a day for 10 years. You know, but that's probably not going to happen anytime soon. So using language modeling, you can understand the profile of a drug, just like with DeepMind's AlphaFold 2, the biological breakthrough of the year for 2020. You know how they did that? Language modeling at the core, understanding relationships between amino acid sequences, all kinds of relationships, thousands of relationships between one amino acid and another amino acid based on their distance and proximity and, you know, other kinds of contexts. That's all language modeling. Apply language modeling to the 7,400 FDA-approved drug compounds today and understand what drug compound is in production right now, approved by the FDA, and then can be reapplied for maybe pancreatic cancer or a biomarker associated to Alzheimer's. You know, so there's a lot of money in Alzheimer's. There's a lot of money in Parkinson's. We're not doing it just for the money, of course. The money just equals funding to us so that we can scale and grow and continue to do this, you know, outside, you know, beyond Earth, for example. So we want to be able to repurpose in this whole process of, you know, they say space is hard. Space biosciences is even harder, solving for human biology in space. But once you do it, it has applications in drug repurposing, precision medicine. Some people want to focus on personalized medicine. Doesn't matter. Applications for everybody on the ground. So if you can take a drug compound and find a different purpose for that drug compound, it can be worth billions and billions of dollars. Okay? So that's just on the drug repurposing side. If you can find an active site on a protein where a drug compound might bind a little better to a protein so that you don't pee it out, as they say, or so that you don't, you know, so there's basically an ineffectual binding with that enzyme or that protein, and the drug becomes pretty much non-effective, you don't want to go down that path. You want to be able to look toward a path where your drug compound becomes more effective or has a different purpose. So that's the area that we operate in, and it takes language modeling to do that.
Fascinating. Really, really, really fascinating. And thanks for sharing that, because I was completely, obviously, unaware that, you know, it was always kind of like, you know, people in lab coats, you know, doing the experimentation, you know, coming up with hypotheses, proving yes or no. And now you've got this whole kind of like, almost like this consciousness that's come into the room and is kind of like plugging in and giving its own perspective on the whole thing. I mean, it's quite obvious when you think about it, but I think we're so caught up in the tech side of it, we don't realize how relevant, you know, AI can be on the biological side of it.
Oh yeah,
I have to ask this question because it's kind of like one of those debates that we'll have at Thanksgiving and at Christmas dinners and lunches, and it's kind of like, well, AI is not a good thing. You know, obviously there's a whole lot of arguments to substantiate why it is a positive thing from your perspective, and you know, how does it become something that's negative, and is there a scenario where it's negative? How do you kind of see yeah. that from a practical and a philosophical perspective?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. So first off, we've been involved in trying to get machines to mimic human cognition for quite some time. It goes back to a book written by Steven Pinker called How the Mind Works, and then another one written by him called Words and Rules. And of course, work done by scientists in the area of what's called CTM, Computational Theory of the Mind, and other failures in AI related to people trying to mimic the entire cognitive process of the brain while not understanding or having a definition of human intellect themselves. If we can't define human intellect, how are we going to create a machine that's smarter than us? That's number one, even if it's based on swarm technology, whatever it is. And then number two, we don't understand how our own consciousness works. And then number three, how do we know that machine intelligence will be similar to human intelligence? I'm going to surmise it'll be completely different than human intelligence. And for that reason alone, it's not going to be a threat. We can't create a threat greater than ourselves right now. That's the bottom line. So I go back and forth with people on this sometimes and they just don't get it. And it's really because when you look at the way an AI system works, comparing an input vector with an output vector, comparing an encoder with a decoder, and what's called a transformer model, which is the core model of most language modeling systems today. You can have linear models and all that other stuff create vectors. But when you look at the core of AI and how an AI system works today, comparing an input vector with an output vector, it's kind of similar to the, forget about the neuron and, you know, the perceptron and all that other stuff, the early AI stuff. What you look at today is based on computational neuroscience and computational cognition, which was IBM's focus for a while, but it's still an academic focus as well in many different locations. But when you look at the way a machine compares two vectors with one another for similarity, it's similar to the way a human does. If I ask you what you thought about, what words you thought of when you thought of the word sky, you know what you would say? Blue. Because most people say blue. I used to do this little trick, you know, raising funding from investors, you know, write something on a card, you know, okay, give me the first word you think of when you think of the word sky, you know, and everybody's like, oh, yeah, blue, you know, it's like very simple trick, right? But getting our machines to think about things similar to the way a human does is very important. When I ask you what you think of when you think of the word river, or car, or forest, you begin to think in symbols, and those symbols have representations, and those are attributes or feature attributes, as we call them in machine learning or AI. And you could think of maybe 10,000 terms, 10,000 objects or words in a day if you were in a conference room by yourself, you know, like Bart Simpson writing on the whiteboard, you know, just like all these words. And, you know, that's exactly what we would need to mimic with a machine, but the machine still would not do it quite like we would. And not just quite like, they do it, you know, pretty much completely different. A machine can have a symbol as a vector embedding in its circuitry or in its memory or coded up, but it's going to make those calculations much differently than we would make calculations in a far more complex ways using treed vectors. Three-dimensional vectors, for example. And the human brain has that non-linear capability that we have yet to explore or understand. And you asked about the philosophy side, so that's what you have there.
It's a great answer, because essentially what you're saying is that you can't have something that isn't wired the way that we are to behave like we are. Like, it's essentially like it's impossible.
Yeah. That's another way of putting it. Yep.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, it's convincing, and it's obviously a logical thing to understand. I want to get to the business side of what it is that you guys are doing on the crypto side of things? Because a lot of people are obviously listening, are going to listen to this podcast, and they're going to be like, okay, well, obviously the topic and what it is that you guys are doing is fascinating and all of that kind of stuff. And I'm pretty sure there's a lot that will probably come off this interview in terms of where people kind of like journey from this point onwards and the knowledge that I'm hoping they get out of this talk. But from the crypto side of things, let's just come back to obviously the efficiency of raising money, the efficiency of essentially, it comes down to the fast tracking aspect of moving capital, having accountability, being able to store that data on chain. But then you mentioned something that really did resonate with me around kind of like being a legitimate business as opposed to a project or a protocol. Speak to me about kind of the differences and the way that you are viewing this thing. I mean, we do have insight into that, but yeah, share your thoughts around that for us.
Sure. So, you know, I should first disclose, as they say on Wall Street, the fact that our family has had a long-standing in the investment banking area and on Wall Street. And that was with my mom. My dad did other things, and I tried to combine them to do what I do today. And, you know, I started out as a software contractor, but then moved into genomics and other things like that. But when you look at the traditional markets, there's a lot to be learned from the traditional markets. I mean, we can, in the crypto space, you can start with things like, you know, people trying to do ICOs, thinking that ICOs, oh, they're like IPOs. No, they are not. They are like friends and family rounds. And why would you give away most of your friends and family round shares? Nobody does that on Wall Street. Nobody does. You give away 400,000. You've got 10 million you're issuing. You give away 400,000 to your friends and your family. You don't just give it to random people so they can sell into it and create sell pressure. No, you don't do that. You don't become like Aurora Coin. They showed the world exactly what not to do and figured they thought crypto was a currency and figured they'd give everybody in Iceland all their crypto so they could seed the market as a currency and so they could get transaction value from it. You know what happened? Everybody needed sandwich money to get away from the volcanoes or whatever, and they sold. That was it. They just sold and they cleared out. Aurora Coin went like this. Look at it today. It's the perfect example of what not to do. The most important thing to understand is crypto is not a currency. It trades like a stock. It does not trade in basis points every day or bips. That's what a currency does. 1/10 of a point? No. No, these things, you know, they spike like stocks. You know, they go down like stocks, you know, except even more with more volatility. So when you look at a crypto, it's more like a stock, a junk bond, a commodity, a futures contract, options, a debenture for that matter. A commodity of any kind, but it's not a currency. So when you treat your crypto like a currency and it's not a currency, you're going to have what I'd like to call the ripple effect. That just means you issue way too many, thinking that the world's going to use it. You think it trades like a currency. It does not. It trades like a stock. So you've just waterlogged, saturated the entire market, which is what happens with scam companies on Wall Street. They issue 100 billion, 10 billion, whatever. You know what Google went out at? 8 million. Netflix, I think it was 5 million. Yeah. Then you release more after that. Of course, you know, in the crypto markets, I mean, in the traditional markets, there are negatives. And that is you can always increase your quote, max supply, which is called your authorized supply. You just write a letter to the SEC as a company and you say, hey, and we know this from experience because we founded a U.S. publicly traded company. So we had to answer to the SEC and we had to consider our options. And one of those options was you can increase your max supply anytime just by writing to the SEC. You can't do that in crypto. And that's the beauty, one of the beautiful aspects of crypto. You also cannot naked short in crypto. You can naked short in the traditional markets. You can make up shares, just make them up. You can also engage in all kinds of white collar, Wall Street criminal activity, which is making a claim that you lost your certificate, but you really didn't. So you're going to, you know, double spend, basically cash out twice, you know, so you can make up fake certificates, you know, And this is what Wall Street has to deal with. But you can't do that with the blockchain. And that's why the DTCC, the clearinghouse that clears, I think, like 14 trillion a day, something like that, in transactions between trades, is interested in blockchain, you know? So anyway, when you look at SBio, the parent company of VXV, we look at the primary advantage the same way Abigail Johnson, who runs Fidelity, might look at it. And Fidelity is one of the largest firms on earth, largest funds, and largest investment houses. And Abigail Johnson, you know, mines Bitcoin in her own office. She lets her employees pay using Bitcoin for lunch. With $8 trillion under assets under management, she can do whatever the heck she wants, probably. But she is solely focused on making sure she paves the way for crypto. And that's by offering ETFs, ETNs, looking at what kind of packaged financial instruments she can use with regulated SEC-approved cryptos. Not scam coins, not meme coins, not shit coins. The SEC will not allow U.S. funds. This includes hedge funds. This includes institutions. This includes all kinds of broker dealers, brokerage houses. None of them. You can't pawn off meme coins to your clientele. That's not going to happen. To your high net worth clients, you know, no. None of that's going to happen. So if you want to be adopted by an ETF or an ETN or a fund, reputable fund, or a fund with $8 trillion under asset management, or Goldman or Morgan, whatever, you become a registered, fully filing token with the SEC. Because then you've opened up a market bigger than the entire crypto market today for yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it's what you were saying. It's about creating businesses that generate revenue at the end of the day. This is the goal.
Yes. And that's the icing on the cake, maybe even more. That's probably the cake and the icing and the cherry. Because revenue is how you build your valuation as a company. You know, there's debt. Revenue leading to profit. That means you're reducing your debt every year. Okay, so you've got revenue. That's great as a crypto. How many companies as a crypto have revenue? Forget about exchanges, because companies will always be worth more than the exchanges they trade on, by the way. Just like NYSE and NASDAQ are worth far, far less than Google, Apple, Amazon, Nvidia, right? So anyway, when you look at being traded as a crypto, you kind of want to make sure that you're available to everybody. You've got revenue at the same time. You've got a great story that you're executing on, but primarily your valuation is going to be defined by your revenue. The most ideal company to have in the crypto space right now is a hybrid company, one with an equity arm, one with a crypto arm. For those that want equity, they will focus on the equity. For those that want crypto, they will focus on the crypto. For those that want both, then you've got to figure out a model that enables them to either get a discount on the market cap of the crypto, or a discount if they're more interested in the equity, or if they're more interested in the crypto than the equity, you give them a greater discount on the equity. So, you know, this is a whole new model, whole new way of operation for companies today. And that really is to expand your footprint and your ability to raise capital on multiple fronts, especially in a global capital marketplace like crypto is.
You know, the thing is that I'd never, even though this is what I do every day, and, you know, we research and we interview and we write about crypto, I've never thought of it in light of what it is that you've just presented right now, even though it is, once again, so damn obvious. It's kind of like, well, what's the whole point? The whole point is, you know, we look at like the Uniswaps and we look at the Aave's and the MakerDAOs, they're generating revenue, and we need to stop referring to them as protocols. I think they're companies, you know, and if you know, that's what are. They're companies with token holders who are effectively shareholders. They've got DAOs, they vote. It's exactly what they are. And maybe we need to stop thinking about them as just protocols, and they're no longer projects. We know that I think they've transcended that now. You know, a lot of them have been here for a lot longer than a year or two, you know, and it's kind of like they're multi-billion dollar companies, and they need to treat themselves and the people that are invested in them in light of the way a company would. So thank you for shedding light on that. I definitely learned a lot today, but that for me was like a real gem in terms of what we do. And then like looking at it from a very different perspective, because it is, it's a very different perspective. I think anyways.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think that there are a lot of crypto companies that either, well, they're, I would say the majority, 99% of them don't have public market experience in dealing with the SEC. And the other half of them, or whatever you want to call it, don't want to open up their kimono and show all the skullduggery they've been doing with their crypto in the public to the SEC. So they're scared, right? So, you know, we've kept it clean. We're all organic. We've never paid for fake volume, you know? I mean, we will get organic liquidity, organic deep liquidity by, you know, going down the path that we're going, focusing on revenue, focusing on customers like AstraZeneca, focusing on the big money, focusing on being accessible to clientele of companies with $8 trillion under asset management. You know, that's the future. And to understand that crypto is a trading vehicle. You know, trying to masquerade it as a new protocol, yeah, that's fine. But down on the ground, you know, the reality on the ground is that people are making money with crypto. That's number one. Number two, crypto is a trading vehicle, just like anything else in the world that's ever been. Tulips used to be a trading vehicle, for that matter.
Yeah. Just to close it off, what does the future hold for you guys, and what are you looking towards in the next couple of years?
Well, in the next couple of years, we hope to be at between 1, 2, or 3 launches per week. And this is launching a payload, which is an experiment where we collect the data, apply language modeling for a biotech or a pharma or a materials company, or a company like NVIDIA that wants to radiation harden their chips. Remember, the space industry is going to be filled with chips. Nothing operates without chipsets and semiconductors. So they need to be radiation hardened. So we're looking at these areas to expand, and we're looking at between 250,000 to 5 million per launch. Each pharma company or biotech will need to do multiple launches. Each chip company, whether it's AMD, Intel, NVIDIA, will also at TSMC, they'll all need to be radiation hardening their chips, because their chips are going to need to go into space, and we'll be there to do that for them. We'll also be there to provide outsourced space biosciences units for every launching company that launches life into space, whether it's plant, animal, and of course human. And then being able to take that, partner with a pharmaceutical company, biotechs, licensing and subscription. Royalties, kind of a thing of the past, but licensing and subscription, maybe a revenue share on the drug compounds that result in precision medicine and solve for human health issues for everybody on the ground. All mankind, as we like to say.
Yeah.
All humankind, for that matter.
Awesome. Thank you, sir, for your time, and also for a lot of really interesting topics that I don't think we actually appreciate enough, but obviously really relevant. Yeah, all the best, and yeah, we'll keep an eye on what it is that you guys are doing. And yeah, I really appreciate your time.
Okay, yeah, sure thing, anytime. And if you want your name and DNA launched into deep space forever, let us know. We're putting together a little list, probably a big
love it. Love it. Thank you everyone for joining us. Please like and subscribe, and let us know what you think about the topic, the interview. Look forward to your feedback. Take it easy, and until we meet next time.